But the issue becomes, when, like you said, maybe we collect five bowls and some bowls are performing really well and some are not. And so that's one of the things that we're trying to improve in our lab is to say, hey, if we've got ejaculates, motility is really similar, but we're getting vastly different, conception rates, for example. Why is that the case? And what can we do to improve our analyses and actually help people who are, you're buying semen, you hope to get your cows pregnant, right?
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
Did you know that beta carotene deficiency can affect fertility rates and reproductive performance? Victus Transition from DSM Firmenich provides beta carotene to help your cattle fertility rates. With early detection in health, reproduction, and feeding, SmaxTech future-proofs your dairy operation. Priority IAC, the only company bringing the fields of microbiology and nutrition together. Adiseo USA, producers of SmartAmine M and MilkPay.com. Modern solutions for modern cows with AHV. Contact us to beat biofilm-related issues in your herd.
Hello and welcome back to the Dairy Podcast Show brought to you by Wisenetics. My name is Barry Bradford from Michigan State University. Today, I'm pleased to welcome Dr. Brad Daigneault to the show. Dr. Daigneault is an assistant professor of reproductive biology in the Department of Animal Sciences at the University of Florida. Brad, thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks a lot for having me. Excited to be here.
So you were telling me, after leaving the beautiful state of Michigan, you've been in Florida for about 4.5 years now. But how did you get into animal science in the first place?
Yeah, it's a good question. So I grew up kind of the second half of my childhood in Texas.
Okay.
And, I actually lived in a really beautiful area just northwest of San Antonio, about 60 miles. It's called the Hill Country.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's a great place to grow up. But, I was pretty immersed in all the ranches out there. Of course, most of them are beef cattle operations, and some of those are south of San Antonio. Most of the dairy's up more towards the panhandle, as you know.
Right.
But, I did a lot of ranch work growing up from the time I was probably 14, 15 years old. So I got to, work with cattle, of course, and more goats than I ever cared to work with again, and horses. So that kind of led me to pursuing an undergraduate degree in animal science at Texas A&M.
And so you went from A&M undergrad, and then where did you get trained after that?
Yeah, so I had actually pretty strong interest in equine reproduction at the time. And actually, we still do quite a bit of equine reproduction in our lab as, kind of independent projects from some of these cattle projects we're doing. So I went up to Colorado State because, people said if you're specifically interested in equine reproduction, that's the place to go.
Okay.
So that was obviously a great place to live, great experience, had some great training there. So we were there for about two and a half years.
So you've moved from the cold mountains to the hot, swampy.
I did, yeah. I've kind of been all over the place at this point. We went from heat in Texas up to Colorado, spent 5 years in the Midwest in Illinois, did a PhD there, actually working with pig sperm at the time and embryos.
Gotcha.
And then up in Michigan for a couple years after that, doing a postdoc, and then decided to move all the way back down south to Florida. So my body doesn't know whether it's hot or cold, which can be a benefit. The weather doesn't bother me so much anymore.
You're adaptable. That's good.
Apparently, yeah.
So, and what is your position there? Like your teaching, research, extension split?
Yeah, so I, primarily research. I've got a 65% research appointment, which means we do, we do a fair amount of research in different areas. Sperm biology, we make a lot of embryos, a lot of cattle embryos. We're starting to make horse embryos now too. And then I teach every fall. So right now I teach Monday, Wednesday, Friday. I teach the undergraduate reproduction class. And then in the spring, I teach an applied reproduction class, which was new about 4 years ago. I started this course, and we do everything, a lot of cattle work, but we work with cattle, horses, pigs, small ruminants. We do artificial insemination. We flush embryos, palpation, ultrasonography. We freeze sperm. We teach students who've maybe never even seen a cow before how to do those sorts of things. So it's a pretty fun course. Yeah.
That sounds fantastic. Yeah, all that experience you have with research and three or four different species is a huge asset for teaching, I'm sure.
Well, it can be helpful, although I had a master's advisor one time who told me I need to focus, and I have to say I think I completely failed that objective, so sorry about that. But it makes for an exciting time. So
I have also, yes, failed to follow that advice I've been given.
Priority IAC, the only company bringing the fields of microbiology and nutrition together and the first ingredient in animal diets. Priority provides a more cost-effective and easier approach to nutrition. We recognize that not all bacteria are created equal. The specific strain truly matters. Priority IAC selects unique strains to provide the best performance in animals, and that's why we call these strains smart bacteria. Founded by Richard Brunig, helping to improve animal health one herd at a time.
What we decided to talk about today is bull fertility, and you know, maybe we'll get into stallions as well. But I guess, you know, we were talking before we started recording how, at least in the U.S. in the dairy industry, very few people have experience around bulls anymore, which is a good thing. Those of my older colleagues that have had to, you know, jump over fences before to escape dairy bulls.
That's right.
So there's upsides, but you know, we start to lose track of some of that aspect of biology that even if we're doing AI, we rely on bulls out there somewhere, right, to generate sperm and stuff. So maybe you could just start by, you know, giving everybody sort of a refresher on how does a bull stud even figure out, is this bull worth collecting? Like, how do we know if a bull's fertile in the first place?
Yeah, you know, I mean, the industry's just changed phenomenally even over the past just couple of decades, right? Like you said, there used to be dairy bulls, and then even, you know, a couple people still maintained cleanup bulls, and we just really don't see that anymore. I mean, everybody's using AI for very good reasons, and that's artificial insemination.
Yep. Not intelligence. Yes.
For me, AI is still artificial insemination, not intelligence. But yeah, so I mean, so the whole industry uses AI, and a lot of the decisions that are made, you know, like when you say, hey, how do we know which bull that we want to use? It's really driven by economics, right? So the industry is looking for the best bulls, and usually they've got pretty good information on the sires in terms of genomics, because the genomics drives a lot of that decision making. But, you know, just because a bull has good genomics does not necessarily mean he's going to produce good quality semen. And, you know, we do know, right? So for these bulls that we have been used for breeding, you know, hundreds and thousands of times, these companies that, you know, we call stud centers, right? They have a pretty good idea of, hey, this bull is either fairly fertile or maybe he's no good or he's very fertile, because they've just used that semen so many times. But the challenge becomes when we've got some of these younger bulls, let's say maybe they're about 8 months old, we're going to start collecting these bulls, and we really don't know, is he going to produce sperm that is acceptable for artificial insemination? So that's when it becomes challenging to look at the quality of that sperm and decide, hey, is this sperm going to be compatible for what we want to use it for?
So AI has been around for 50 years or more. What's the traditional way that has been used to assess whether, you know, sperm is going to be fertile enough to even bother with?
Yeah, you know, so to be honest with you, not a whole lot has changed, right? And you know, in my view, we're still pretty using pretty basic techniques and in some senses archaic technology, because it's the best we've got, and it's not terrible, right? So typically, I mean, as most people know, whether you're collecting semen shoot side and you just want to look at a sample on a slide with a microscope by the shoot, or maybe you've collected a bull at a stud center and you're going to look at it before you freeze it and then look at it after you freeze it, we're just looking for motility, right? We want to know, are the sperm moving? Because first of all, if the sperm are moving, we know one thing for certain, and that's that it's alive, right? That's step one. So it's got to be alive to fertilize an egg. And, you know, when we look at motility, it's what we're looking for are how many of the total sperm in that ejaculate are moving. So are 60% moving? And then we can look at individual motility. And we do that by diluting the sample and really asking, okay, of the sperm that are moving, how many are moving in a straightforward motion? And we call that progressive motility. And that's a pretty good indication of fertility. That's the thing. It's a pretty good indication, but the problem becomes when it doesn't always predict fertility. And sometimes we say motility is an indication of fertility, but it doesn't always do a great job of separating the bowls from the ones that are acceptable to the ones that are not going to produce that many calves.
You know, I guess you put, if you put yourself in the shoes of somebody running a bull stud, you know, you collect five bulls, the motility looks similar across all of them. You generate 5,000 straws of semen, and eventually, ideally, you actually get data back on successful AI, right? And if you see a difference, what might explain that, and what do they do in that situation?
Yeah, you know, so I mean, that's the idea, right? You collect these semen, you collect the ejaculate, and what the AI centers are going to be looking for is motility. They also want to know, do the sperm look normal? Right. So we just call that morphology. And we can use other techniques and look at different structures of sperm that are important for fertilization. And that gives us a pretty good idea. And, you know, the when I say it's still kind of an archaic method, that's because if you just collect an ejaculate from a bowl, right, and you put it on a slide, and we say, hey, we think about 60% of the sperm are moving, it's pretty subjective, right? Maybe I say 60%, maybe you say 80%. So the industry has evolved because now we use, and we've been using for years, these devices called computer-assisted sperm analysis or something along that nature, where it's a device that we can put sperm on a slide and we can use a machine that can count every individual sperm and give you a really objective assessment and say, hey, actually, it's not 60% of the sperm that are motile, it's 67%. So that's really objective and that's really useful and that helps to kind of standardize it. But the issue becomes, you know, when, like you said, maybe we collect five bulls and some bulls are performing really well and some are not. And so that's one of the things that we're trying to improve in our lab is to say, hey, if we've got ejaculates, motility is really similar, but we're getting vastly different, you know, conception rates, for example, why is that the case? And what can we do to improve our analyses and actually help people who are, you know, you're buying semen, you hope to get your cows bred, right?
Yeah. Okay. So what are some of those techniques? What are you sniffing into for ways to better discern, you know, high quality semen from less?
Yeah, it's a, you know, it's a good question. There's a lot of good work being done out there. And one of the things that we're looking at is to understand that, you know, so let's say, for example, you collect semen from a bowl, you freeze it, you thaw it out, and you say, hey, motility looks great. Let's say 65% motility. One of the things that we're really interested in understanding is how does that motility perhaps change over time, right? Because you got to put the sperm inside the cow. And it could take 6 hours to fertilize that egg, or it could take, let's say, as long as 24 hours. And so what these devices, like that machine I told you about that's looking at motility, what it's actually doing is measuring indirectly how the mitochondria are functioning, right? Because remember, sperm have these tails on them. And the only way that sperm can move is if that tail beats. And it's the mitochondria that's really the powerhouse for that. So what we've said is, okay, what if we could look at different functions of that mitochondria and get more measurements than just how well the sperm moves, right? What if we said, hey, if we challenge sperm and we say you can't use this part of your mitochondria, you're only allowed to use a portion of it, what capacity do you have to keep traveling basically towards the site of fertilization? So we've got these machines that we use. In fact, they're kind of funny names. One of them is called the Seahorse. Doesn't have anything to do with the Seahorse. And we're using another one called the Ouroboros. But basically what we can do is we can put sperm in these little devices and then we can challenge the mitochondria and see, hey, rather than just looking at motility under a microscope, if we challenge the mitochondria using things that shut down different portions, do some bulls or the sperm from some bulls have the ability to maybe have higher oxygen consumption rates? And is that a good thing? Because maybe it's not a good thing, right? Those are the things that we're really looking at, is to see if we can develop more sensitive methodology. And, you know, I'll tell you one analogy I often use. One way to think about this is let's think about like a marathon, for example. You know, you see the Boston Marathon, and if you've ever watched it on TV, you've got like hundreds of people lined up at the start line, right? And maybe everybody looks kind of similar, like kind of similar body types. Everybody's hopefully probably pretty fit at that time, right? How do you look at all of those people and predict, hey, who's gonna last the whole marathon? And so, you know, when that start gun goes off or whatever they use now, it's still really darn difficult because the whole mass moves together, right? Over time, it becomes really evident these people that look the same, maybe they ate the same thing for breakfast, slept the same last night, they start to separate. Right. And you can really start to tell which people can handle that distance more than others. And so we're trying to kind of use that same analogy for sperm by not only using different ways to look at the mitochondria, but one thing that we do that I think is really different is we don't just look at sperm one time. We actually have this media that we put sperm in, and we can hold it for 24 hours and it stays alive pretty well, actually. So then we can say, we can look at the, you know, just like people who are separating during that marathon, we can look at sperm at a longer time point and say, hey, maybe this bull, for whatever reason that we don't understand and we can't capture using all of these methods that we traditionally use in the dairy business, right? Maybe this bull is actually going to get better rates if we look at these measures, better conception rates. So that's another way we're kind of looking at this.
Yeah, you kind of alluded to this. You can find differences in oxygen consumption rate, which is a proxy for mitochondrial capacity at some level. Do you have some results so far from a sampling of bulls with differences in actual conception rates showing how this is related or not yet?
We do. We actually do have some data, and we published some data about a year ago using the seahorse assay. And I'll tell you, one of the things, so at that time, we didn't actually have the fertility data on the bulls, right? So basically, just to make sure everybody understands what we're talking about here, we got some bull sperm and we said, okay, if we've got these bulls that their semen looks almost identical, and I mean it was almost identical in terms of motility, the first question we asked is, if we use this instrumentation called the Seahorse, that can actually tell us more about the mitochondria than just looking under a slide at how sperm move, are there really differences between bulls? That's the first question, right? Because if there's no difference, then the assay is no good to anybody. So we were actually able to answer that question because we did find that some bulls' mitochondria simply consume more oxygen than other bulls. Or what's actually really interesting is that, you know, sperm can actually, there's two ways that sperm can actually utilize or make energy to move. And one is through something that we call oxidative phosphorylation, and the other is through using sugar, glycolysis. And what we found is over time, some of these bulls shifted, right? So in other words, they might have used oxidative phosphorylation as a source of energy, and then over time, they start to depend more on sugars. And so that becomes really interesting, right? Because there's a lot we don't know about the female reproductive tract. Remember, the sperm have to go, we deposit it, whether it's through AI or whether the bull mounts that cow or that heifer, that semen is eventually going to go through her cervix, and then it's going to go all the way through the uterus. And there's a whole lot of things in the uterus that the sperm can use for energy. And it could be that maybe these bulls need more sugar towards the site of fertilization, or maybe they need less sugar. We don't know what that is. But just by looking at this, you know, basic sperm biology that's maybe on the surface a little, you know, maybe doesn't seem that translatable, right? It's like, how can we use that in the AI business? Well, if we say, hey, it looks like bull sperm needs more sugar, we could actually add that to semen extenders, or we could ask questions like, hey, what are these cows eating, right? What's their diet? And is there maybe a diet that would be more conducive to fertilization if we change their diet closer to the time we're going to inseminate? And so right now, actually, we've got bulls that we're actually just finishing an experiment today where we do know these bulls' individual fertilities. We had some semen that was donated to us very graciously by select sires, and we know some of these bulls may be more fertile than others, and we're able to use some of this instrumentation to see if there's differences. And we don't have quite all that data wrapped up yet, but we're looking forward to analyzing.
Bulls can also differ quite a bit in sperm yield. Is that right?
They can, right? So, and what's interesting about that is you kind of open up a really interesting can of worms with that question, because we know that some bulls produce more sperm than other bulls, right? And that's largely dependent on how large their testes are. And that can change with age. Usually as bulls get older, they'll reach a capacity at some point, but you know, if you're talking about an 8-month-old bull to a 4-year-old bull, the 4-year-old bull is going to produce more sperm almost every time. But the you know, when I said you kind of open up, you know, a can of worms for more questions, one thing that's really important to consider also is that even between individual collections, right? Let's say you've got a great bull and you collect semen, you look at all of these things that we've been talking about, motility, morphology, you know, is the membrane intact? It looks great. If you collect that bull 3 or 4 days later, usually he's going to look okay. But there is a lot of what we call, there's a lot of flexibility between the ejaculates or a lot of changes that can happen between the ejaculates, right? It's not always consistent. And that can be due to a number of different things. Maybe the bull got vaccinated. And that had an effect, or maybe it was hot that day. And so that's another question, is can we take these individual ejaculates and be able to predict, at least to some degree, the fertility of that ejaculate based on what we know about these sperm traits?
Yeah. One other thing I was thinking about is, I don't know the percentage now, but, I would suspect roughly a third of dairy cow AIs now are being carried out with sex semen. And so I'm just sitting here wondering, as you're describing the work you're doing, could you envision in the future where the flow cytometers that separate male and female sperm could also be assessing sort of mitochondrial density or something to get a better prediction of a really, really fertile sperm to be sorted?
So I do think that, because it's usually like some sort of flow cytometry process, that there is potential to add other steps where we can measure different traits at the same time. But it gets a little tricky, right? Because in order to sort sperm, not usually, always, these sperm are going to be put in a media that's really conducive to keeping them alive, because it takes a while to sort sperm, right? So anytime we change the media that we put sperm in, we change the way they move. And sometimes we may want sperm to swim, I guess we say, to be more quiescent. We don't want them to be as energetic, right? And so maybe if we do that, we kind of artificially change the mitochondria's ability to respond. So I do think that it's certainly possible, but you know, that's another challenge to this. Like when we talk about the dairy industry, right? And just in general, that you've got lots of stud centers here collecting semen from bulls, and you've got maybe veterinarians or technicians AIing, everybody's thawing out slightly differently. Everybody's using slightly different freezing diluents. And so it becomes difficult to standardize one approach to say, hey, for example, okay, you're over at Michigan State, you looked at this bull and you got 70% motility. Maybe I looked at it here and got 50% motility. What do we have to do as an industry where we can be more consistent, and so we can be repeatable and make sure people getting the sperm are seeing what we're seeing? That's one of the challenges too.
So if you had to say you know, with what you know today, if you had to say, now, here's the one best metric we have of bull fertility, what would you point to?
Well, I think the general consensus is still that motility is the best indicator of fertility.
Okay.
It just is, and it makes a lot of sense why. But, you know, one other kind of dynamic to add to this is, you know, remember that these bulls that are used in the dairy industry are already highly selected. Right. I'll probably get into trouble with a geneticist here, but the genetic diversity, at least we can say in dairy cattle, is so much less diverse than other species because we know that there are certain traits that we want to capture. Right. And then we say we add one more layer of complexity on that. We say, hey, we want to be able to tell differences in fertility. They all have pretty similar fertility at this point. Right.
Okay.
And, you know, there may be differences. And of course, you're always going to have outliers that we're never going to get rid of that. So I think one of the things that we should maybe be asking, if we really want to phrase the question correctly, is maybe not how can we identify the most superior ejaculate for fertilization, but maybe how can we screen or kind of weed out those samples that are never going to make it and are going to be costly to producers. I think that's what the industry is really striving for right now. And a lot of this has to do with predictive ability, right? Everybody wants to be able to predict the next big thing. So, and there's a big push to get these bulls that are very young collected at an early age. That's the thing, right? Because the genomics is moving in some ways at this point faster than we can keep up with. Like, so for example, hey, we know that this bull calf, before it hits the ground, we have a pretty good idea he's the one that we want to collect semen from in 8 months. So the question becomes, can we develop the technology to collect that semen and then look at the sperm and say, hey, yeah, we think that he's going to be able to produce calves, or no, this guy's not quite ready yet. That's the challenge right now. And so there's this kind of divergence, and, you know, there's a lot of good work being done out there. We're talking about motility and mitochondria, but people are looking at, you know, biomarkers. Right. Like, so everybody would love to find a single biomarker that you could say, hey, this is your guy right here. Right. It's just not that easy, because most of the time fertility is like a what we call a multigenic trait. There's lots of different traits that come together to explain fertility, if you will. Right. So, you know, there's genomics involved. There's what we call epigenomics, and those are areas that are still being really developed to understand how do those influence the genomic ability of these cells to express or not express. Also, you know, people are also looking at things like metabolomics. What are the sperm metabolizing? Or maybe the sperm aren't metabolizing. Maybe there's things that are metabolizing in other fluids that sperm come into contact with that are changing the way sperm behave. So there's a lot of different aspects that go into this, but I don't think that we'll ever get away from taking a straw of semen, thawing it out, putting it under a scope, and having to look at that sperm and make some sort of assessment on whether or not it's suitable for AI.
Yeah, especially since it can be done pre and post.
Exactly.
Freezing, right? So you can make sure it's still viable after freezing. Yeah.
That's right. And again, because that bull was great yesterday doesn't mean his ejaculate's going to be great today. So we're always going to have to do that, right? We're always going to have to look at the quality.
Yep. That makes sense.
It's time for our famous three.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
Our Yeast 40 ruminal and intestinal double modulation by ICC Animal Nutrition. Natural Biologics delivers cost-effective solutions to improve health and productivity, helping conquer the rumen health and immunity challenges your animals face. Your partner for extra animal performance, Bergen Schmidt Animal Nutrition. Excellent, a novel product for the management of hypocalcemia. It's uncomplicated excellence. Elevate animal performance with Bergen Schmidt Animal Nutrition, your trusted ally in excellence. Their high-quality feed ingredients like coated nutrients and fat powders provide ruminants with extra energy, boosting health, productivity, and cost efficiency. Unleash your herd's potential with Berg and Schmidt.
All right, well, we've got three big questions we throw at everybody. It's time. First of all, I know you don't just focus on dairy, but we'll see what you can come up with. What's your favorite dairy-related book or resource?
You know, dairy-related book or resource. I'll tell you what, I often, you know, I think that there's a lot of value to these extension articles that are published online. Mm-hmm. And, you know, not just they're not really meant from a research perspective, right? But so for a source of information that you can rely on, they're coming from these public universities. I think they're great. And I actually use those for teaching quite a bit.
Yep.
So I'll put those right into the coursework as references to build on some of these things that we're talking about. So I wouldn't say I've got one specific reference, but I will utilize a lot of those extension articles because I think that they're very well done.
Yeah, and I'm one of the values is the length is suitable a lot of times for what you need, right? You don't need a 20-page piece on every little.
Especially for someone like me who can't focus. Just get to the point or I'm done reading it.
Yeah. All right, what about your favorite book or resource outside of agriculture?
You know, I used to do a lot of reading, but ironically, before I was heavily involved in academia.
Yeah, right. And that's sad.
There's no time to read, right? I mean, I remember when I was a kid, I read just about everything. I probably read The Lord of the Rings, I don't know how many times. But I'll tell you what's interesting now, you know, as my kids get older, they start to have these requirements for English literature class.
Yeah.
So my oldest daughter said she had to read The Odyssey. And I actually happen to have a copy that my mom gave me. So I've been trying to keep up because I feel like those are the things that now I go back and read and I think, wow, those are maybe a little bit more meaningful, or some really boring stuff that's actually not so boring anymore. I picked up a book. It was Thomas Paine. What is the title of that book? I can't remember right now. But anyways, like some of the founding stuff of America.
Yeah.
Yeah. Those are. Common sense. That's why I couldn't remember it. Yeah, common sense. Boring stuff, but you know, maybe different perspective than Bull Sperm.
That's good. And good way to connect with your kids too when they're trying to understand that stuff. That's terrific. All right. Last question. In your opinion, and you could delete dairy out of here, it probably doesn't matter. In your opinion, what sets successful dairy professionals apart from those who are less successful?
I think that the one thing that seems to be common upon just people in general who are successful, I think that you have to have something has to drive you. You know, whether you're really curious or maybe you're OCD about something, right? I mean, and it can be something as simple as like a really good mechanic isn't somebody who's just going to open the hood and start turning wrenches. Like they really want to know the source of the problem, right? I think that's one big thing. And I think the other thing, you know, everybody used to say you've got there's no substitute for hard work. And that's absolutely true. But I'll tell you, I don't know any dairy producers that don't work hard, right? Everybody's busting their butt, you know, every morning, every night. So what sets some people apart from others, I think it's really important at some point to make sure that if you're working hard, you're actually working hard to do the right things, right? So I actually, you know, it's funny, we talked about this last week. I coach a lot of girls softball. I have a different daughter now, not the one reading the Odyssey. And, you know, we'll do these drills, right? And they may start something and they may do it wrong. And you know, it's the same thing, whether we're talking about our work, whether I'm doing it here in the lab or a dairy producer, or you're on the field trying to compete. You can work hard and bust your butt, but you want to make sure you're doing the right thing. I think that's really important.
You could run 100 miles an hour the wrong direction. It's not helping you at all, right?
That's right. Or in the case of sperm, you could be swimming the wrong way.
That's right. Way to tie that back in. Good job. Set successful sperm apart from those that are less successful.
I guess it depends on your perspective.
Well, again, our guest today has been Dr. Brad Daigneault. Thank you so much for joining us. I enjoyed the conversation.
Yes, thanks so much for having me. And, you know, I look forward to talking with you in the future.
Sounds good. Well, this has been another episode of the Dairy Podcast Show. If you haven't subscribed yet, what are you thinking? Well, actually, you can fix this problem. You can go click subscribe now or like it so that you don't miss the next episode. And I will look forward to seeing you next time.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with Elite Remote Talent without a time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on your $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.